My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and before we get stuck into today's album and today's episode, I just wanted to take a minute to congratulate Rami Malek for his amazing win at the Oscars on Sunday night, Best Actor, for his portrayal of Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody. So anyone who knows me at all knows how much I've loved Queen from a very young age, and I was excited yet nervous to see the film. I didn't really know how it was going to turn out. Anyone who followed the film closely during its kind of pre-production, even its production, has known it had quite a bumpy ride. Quite a few moments where people thought potentially that it might not get made or that it might be an absolute disaster. But the film's come out. People love it. It's breaking records all over the place. And it appears that Rami Malek's just kind of swept the board in terms of Best Actor for awards season. Congratulations to Rami and everyone involved with Bohemian Rhapsody, because I think it won more awards at the Oscars than any other on Sunday night. I think maybe it won four. Quite a few of the technical awards it got. So yeah, it was just a moment to kind of cut in there and just say congratulations to Rami. Congratulations to Queen, who absolutely amazing performance with Adam Lambert to open the show. Congratulations to them. So on today's episode of My Classic Album, for the first time, we're going to be returning to a band where we've covered an album of theirs before on the podcast. So back in episode 11, I believe, Beth Blade from Beth Blade and the Beautiful Disasters chose Kiss's second album, Hotter Than Hell, as her classic album. And a couple of months later, we welcomed Rob Wild onto the show. Now, Rob is the lead singer of Tiger Tales and Midnight City, and he helped me celebrate 30 years of Hysteria by Def Leppard. Now, that was released in August of 1987. And today's classic album was also released, I think, in the September of 1987, and Rob's come back to chat about that one. So as you can guess, it is a Kiss album. It's Kiss's Crazy Nights. So not only is it the first time that we're having a second album by a band or a singer for the podcast, it's also the first time that we're welcoming a guest back onto the podcast. So two firsts. And this is a really interesting one. It's a album that Kiss fans sometimes, you know, there's a couple of albums that Kiss fans maybe don't enjoy as much as the others. The Elder is a really good example of that, and Crazy Nights would be another, and we do talk a little about why that is. I guess the headline from this episode is that Crazy Nights is a hugely overlooked album, and there's a few reasons for that that Rob and I will get into and we will talk about. So it's a really fascinating chat about an album that has all the ingredients in the summer of 1987 to become an absolute monster hit, alongside the albums like Slippery When Wet by Bon Jovi, Hysteria by Def Leppard, Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses, which we're doing in a couple of weeks' time. But for some reason, in America at least, it just didn't get off the ground. But over here, it did. Which, you know, it's an interesting thing. You know, we in the UK really lapped it up. In America, it's one of the less successful Kiss albums. In the UK, it is the most successful Kiss album. But here's the time to share some love for Crazy Nights. Our special guest today is Rob Wild from Midnight City. But before we get to Rob, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's what you need to know about Crazy Nights. Crazy Nights is the 14th studio album by American rock band Kiss. Recorded in the spring of 1987, it was the second album with the lineup of founding members Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons, along with drummer Eric Carr and guitarist Bruce Kulick. After several years of guitarists joining and leaving the band, Paul Stanley persuaded the rest of Kiss to wait for producer Ron Nevison to become available, being impressed with Ron's work with the likes of Heart and Ozzy Osbourne. The result was a more polished pop metal sound, comparable to the likes of Bon Jovi and Def Leppard, and for the first time in Kiss's career, a strong emphasis on synths and keyboards. With a lot critically and financially riding on the album, Kiss chose Crazy Crazy Nights as the album's lead single. It reached number 65 on the Billboard Hot 100, yet in what would prove to be true of its parent album, Crazy Crazy Nights achieved far greater success in the UK, reaching number 4 on the UK singles chart. Follow-up single Reason to Live hit number 33 in the UK, while beating Crazy Crazy Nights by just one place in the US, reaching number 64. Final single Turn on the Night made less of a splash, only charting in the UK at number 41 in the singles chart. The album mirrored the success of its singles, reaching number 18 in the United States, but reaching number 4 on the UK album chart, still to this day, Kiss's highest charting position. While Crazy Nights was considered a flop in their home country, that certainly wasn't the case in the United Kingdom. Regardless, Crazy Nights was certified platinum in the United States in early 1988. After many years in the wilderness, many Kiss fans, particularly in the UK, look back on the album with fondness, and after years of being conspicuously missing from their set lists, Kiss resurrected Crazy Crazy Nights during their Sonic Boom Over Europe tour in 2010. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Crazy Nights, and I have here with me an old friend to the show who's chosen Crazy Nights to talk about tonight. This is Rob Wilde. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm great. Welcome back. Thank you very much. Before we get started, thanks for rejoining us on My Classic Album.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Yeah. So just to kind of start things off, why have you chosen Crazy Nights to talk about today on My Classic Album?
Well, number one, because I absolutely love it. Anybody that knows me will tell you that I'm the biggest Kiss freak on earth, my favourite band of all time. And I think it's just an album that really gets overlooked a lot. Obviously, we'll get into the whole thing of how I discovered the album, I'm sure, this evening. But, you know, for me, it was my introduction to Kiss. And then I kind of backtracked and, you know, got into all the 70s stuff as well. But I think it's an album that just gets really, really overlooked. It's still in my, you know, my top five Kiss albums. And that's the main reason. I just absolutely love this album.
Yeah. So, I mean, the last time you were here, we celebrated 30 years of Hysteria by Def Leppard, which was actually released only a month earlier than Crazy Nights. And we've talked about you discovering bands like Bon Jovi and Ura previously, which then led into Def Leppard. Did I hear you just say there that Crazy Nights was your first exposure to Kiss back in 1987?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was, yeah. I mean, like I said, you know, the first two bands was Bon Jovi in Europe, which was 86. And then 87 was the two bands from 87 that I really, you know, two bands that I still absolutely love to death today. You know, Def Leppard was the first one. And then Kiss, who came along in September of 87. Yeah. It was weird because, you know, back then, I mean, obviously there was no internet and I was way too young. I was only 10 years old in 1987, so there was not, you know, I hadn't discovered, you know, like Kerrang magazine and all those rock magazines. So the only music really that I was aware of was music that was actually getting into the UK charts at the time. But suddenly, just out of nowhere, came this band Kiss that I'd never, you know, I knew nothing about, and they suddenly just came out and had this huge hit with the title track of the album.
And I mean, 1987, as you say, was just an awesome year. If you're into that kind of music, you know, you've got Whitesnake's self-titled album, you've got Slippery When Wet actually came out a year earlier, Hysteria, Aerosmith, Permanent Vacation, before we even get to Appetite for Destruction, that list, and then of course Crazy Nights, that really captures the mood of what people wanted to listen to and what they were into in the late 80s.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's another couple of albums from 87 that I really loved. Heart's album, Bad Animals, again, I loved the 80s Heart. When I backtracked to their kind of back catalogue, I wasn't really into the 70s stuff, but those big 80s albums were huge. And then there was, you know, there was Girls, Girls, Girls. Motley Crue was 87 as well. And later down the line, I didn't discover them at the time, but, you know, White Lion with the Pride album. So there was a lot of really big albums that came out in 87. It was a good year, like you said.
So Crazy Nights is a really interesting album, and we've started to touch on this because many listeners in America would probably debate why we were having an episode dedicated to it. But over here, like, Crazy Nights was a big deal. I mean, we'll touch on the varying levels of success of the album as we go on. What was it like, kind of, you'd said kind of it was in the charts, it was what you were hearing at that time. What was it like when that album was out and the success that it kind of achieved over here?
Yeah, it was a weird one because it just sort of came out of nowhere for me. I'd never heard of them before. I just heard it on the radio. You know, me and my older sister would always listen to the Radio 1 singles countdown. They used to go play all the tracks from 40 to number one, and we used to listen to it on a Sunday afternoon. I just remember it was in the middle of all this pop stuff. Suddenly came this song that, to me, you know, as a little kid, I just thought it sounded like Bon Jovi, you know, and I was kind of, I like this because it sounds like, you know, something off Slippery When Wet. And then it's, you know, I think it entered the charts probably in the, you know, 30 or 29 or whatever. And every week it just kept climbing up the charts. And I'm pretty sure it got to number 4 in the UK, which was by far the biggest single in the UK and one of the biggest singles, you know, in Europe as well. It didn't really do anything for me in America, which is weird. And I think Germany as well, a lot of European countries, it was a big single. Then not long after that, they were actually on Top of the Pops. They weren't in the studio, but they had sort of like a live feed to LA, I think it was. That's when I saw them for the first time, and I thought they looked cool. You know, I thought they kind of, I could tell that they were quite a bit older than the, you know, Bon Jovi and Def Leppard, but they still look cool. You know, they just look like those guys with black hair, you know. So, but there's so much energy in that live performance, especially from Paul Stanley, and it was just kind of right there and then I was just, you know, fell in love with the band and, you know, went out and bought the cassette and absolutely played the thing to death.
And I mean, if we talk about the album for a second and how the success that the album had, and we compare it to some of these other albums we're talking about. So just to give people a bit of an idea, and I know it's not all about kind of where things get in the charts, but it shows you kind of how successful it was. So Crazy Nights reached number 4, and the same as the single, they both reached number 4 in their respective charts. Slippery When Wet reached number 6. Whitesnake's album reached number 8. Appetite for Destruction reached number 5. So I'm sure if we're talking overall sales, that list would tell a very different story. But it does show that in 1987, we in the UK were very into this album and very into that single.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like you're saying, I mean, I didn't realize that, you know, until you mentioned those figures. But yeah, for whatever reason, people just really got on board with the band. I know, I think the album before Asylum didn't really do anything in the UK. I think Animalize and Lick It Up, the two previous albums to those, I think they did well on the album chart, if I remember rightly, you know. So I think when things sort of, when he took the makeup off and they went, started going, you know, into the 80s, into the mid 80s, that's when really America seemed to have almost kind of lose a bit of interest in them. And that's when they became, I think they became a lot more popular in Europe then, kind of peaked really in well, definitely in the UK. I mean, on the Crazy Nights album, because the album after that, you know, they didn't even, you know, didn't even scratch the surface. And then, you know, the Revenge album, and, you know, it was really Crazy Nights that was the big one in the UK. Like you said, people really got on board with it.
So we last covered Kiss on My Classic Album back in episode 11. So Kiss are the first band that we've done two albums for on the podcast. Beth Blade chose Hotter Than Hell as her classic album. And at that stage, Kiss were like a young band waiting for their big break. By the time we roll around to Crazy Nights, and you've touched on this a bit already, a lot had changed. Ace Frehley and Peter Criss are no longer in the band, and Kiss have lost the face paint, Unmasked a few years earlier, and that red hot success they'd seen in the late 70s had cooled off considerably. Would it be fair to say that the stakes were really high for Kiss with the Crazy Nights album, particularly in America where things had kind of cooled off a bit?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they were definitely looking for a big hit album. And it's weird, like you said, when everything kind of died off, I think initially when he took the makeup off for the Lick It Up album, big interest in that, because it was the whole thing of Kiss had taken the makeup off. And there was, so that album did quite well, you know, as a result of that. And then the kind of popularity started sort of going down, it sort of peaked, and then it kind of started going down a little bit. And I think once the novelty of the fact that they'd taken the makeup off had died down, I think they started to lose quite a lot of sort of popularity. I mean, their albums, they were all either gold albums or platinum albums, so they were doing in you know, 500,000 to a million albums. But compared to the, you know, the likes of Def Leppard and Bon Jovi, who were selling 12 million albums, I think basically for the first time in Kiss's kind of career, rather than setting the trend and having all the kind of the bands hit, and they all did, you know, all those 80s bands, all, you know, it all came from Kiss, you know, the image and the stage show and even the songs. You know, if you ask any of those bands, from, you know, Poison to Rat to Warren, whoever you want to ask, that, you know, their influences were all coming from Kiss. But I think in the mid 80s, I think Kiss realized that they were kind of playing catch up, But I think they also just really wanted a big album because not long before that, I think you mentioned Aerosmith before. I mean, they had a big resurgence in the late 80s with, you know, Permanent Vacation and the Pump album. And I think they maybe looked at bands like that. And even Heart, who were, again, a 70s band and had two absolutely humongous albums in the mid-80s. I think they looked at those bands and said, well, we want some of that. I think it was a definite decision to, yeah, let's try and get it. Let's try and write and record a hit album. And I think you can kind of tell that with it is quite a bit of a diversion from the track that they were on, really. And I think it was a definite conscious decision to record a hit album.
Yeah. So by the mid-80s, Paul Stanley was growing frustrated with Gene Simmons, who seemed more focused on his Hollywood career and producing younger bands. So in 1995's Kistry, Paul recalls confronting Gene about his priorities. He says, "We were in the parking lot one day, and I said to Gene, 'Look, you're off doing all these other things while still reaping the benefits of this band, and I'm getting screwed. It's not fair for me to put in this kind of time while somebody else who is supposed to be my partner is not.' And Gene looked at me and said, 'That's fair.' I could have used Gene's input, but my attitude at that point was that I certainly wasn't going to listen to a guy who's off managing cabaret singers and producing five bands while I was trying to make an album." How important was Paul Stanley at this point in keeping Kiss together?
He was fundamental, you know, through the entire 80s period, really. I mean, through the 80s, he was Kiss. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I think Gene Simmons really only got back on board, you know, full time and was sort of 100% with the band for the Revenge album, which was a much, much heavier album and a much sort of darker album for him. And that's really when Gene got back on board and, you know, and started writing good songs again, like, you know, Unholy and songs like that. But in the 80s, he just seemed completely lost. And, you know, I've read obviously many, many books and seen many interviews where he was just, I think the main thing was with Gene was he just didn't know how to be an 80s rock star. You know, he was used to being the demon and, you know, throwing up blood and being this sort of, you know, creepy, horrible character on stage. And then suddenly the 80s was all about, you know, pretty boys and the exact opposite of what Gene was. So, you know, I mean, he had some absolutely horrendous wardrobe malfunctions, shall we say, especially around the Asylum era where he was wearing, you know, like sequined costumes and stuff. He looked like he was, you know, like a little old lady going to the bingo or something. You know, he was really bad. And you could tell he was making a real effort to kind of, okay, I've got to try and look like, you know, how bands are looking nowadays with the makeup and the over the top sort of 80s kind of stage clothes. But he just was failing miserably. And I think he was just lost in the 80s. I just don't think he really understood where he belonged in the band. Hence why he started going off and doing all these absolutely awful movies and producing all these bands that, you know, 90% of them were absolutely awful and none of them really did anything either. So I think it was left to Paul to carry the flag, really, because the songs that Gene did bring in during the mid-80s were pretty bad. I mean, I would say during the 80s, there was probably only maybe, like, you know, certainly less than 10 songs that Gene wrote, say from Creatures of the Night up to Revenge, that were any good. You know, most of the albums, there was a couple of, I think the Animalize album was really when Gene was absolutely at his worst. I mean, every song that he wrote on that album was absolutely hideous. It was just the worst song. So I think Paul just looked at it and said, well, you know, if I want the band to continue, I'm going to have to do all the work. And luckily for Kiss, I mean, Paul really, really, embraced the whole 80s kind of hair metal thing, and he was just I think he slided very easily from being the kind of 70s you know, glam rock guy to the 80s hair metal guy. You know, I think he carried the image really well, and I think he just got what those hair metal bands were about, and whereas Gene clearly didn't. So without a doubt, I mean, he was 100% the reason behind, you know, everything that they did, really, in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, Paul was able to use Gene's distractions to his advantage when he persuaded the rest of the band to wait for Ron Nevison to become available to produce Crazy Nights. So you've talked about Heart's two albums. Ron produced both of those, and he also produced Ozzy Osbourne's Ultimate Sin, among many others that were huge, huge hits in the 80s. The question I was going to ask you was, have you listened to any of his other produced albums? Obviously, you're a big fan of the Heart albums. Do you think he brings a particular style to his albums in the same way that, say, Rick Rubin does?
Well, they did at the time. You know, I could always tell when Ron Nevison had produced an album. He had a kind of a glossiness about his production, which I, you know, a lot of people, it's kind of like one of those things a lot of people really don't like, that kind of stuff. I really do. I think the two Heart albums, Heart and Bad Animals, which, like you said, were great. The Aussie album's great. He did a Europe album in 88 called Out of This World, which was the follow-up to The Final Countdown. That's a great-sounding album. Then a few years down the line, he did the first Vince Neil solo album. You know, that absolute ton of stuff. But he was also really well-known in the 70s. You know, he did a lot of, I think there's something, I'm not entirely sure who he produced in the 70s, but he produced a lot of big bands in the 70s as well, if you look into his stuff. But kind of that 80s gloss, a little bit overproduced, really, I guess you could say. But I love that stuff. You know, I really like that. I mean, he obviously really liked using keyboards and making sure that the keyboards kind of came through, whereas a lot of producers just always try and bury keyboards, you know, as if it's kind of like they're not really that important. But he kind of brought keyboards up to the forefront of a lot of his mixes as well.
What's interesting is that kind of if we're talking about the emphasis on keyboards, you would assume that would lead to kind of an absence of guitar. But that's very much not true of this album. And one of the side effects, I guess, a happy side effect of Gene's disinterest in Kiss at that time is the emergence of Bruce Kulick on guitar. So it's his second album with Kiss at this point. And with Gene absent for parts of the Crazy Nights sessions, he has a much more prominent role in terms of songwriting. And I'd argue the album full stop. What are your thoughts on Bruce Kulick in general as a part of Kiss? And how important is he on Crazy Nights to the overall sound?
Oh, Bruce was by far, you know, my favorite Kiss guitar player, you know, and that goes over, you know, the top of Ace Frehley, you know. I think he was brought in at a time when, again, everything was changing and there was suddenly a new sort of style of guitar playing, spearheaded by, you know, Eddie Van Halen with all the finger tapping and all that kind of stuff. And he just opened that box for all those 80s guitar players to come on board with it. You know, again, they were looking for a guitar player that could compete alongside people like Eddie Van Halen, Steve Vai and Joe Satriani and all those guys. And, you know, no disrespect to Ace Frehley because he's great, but I mean, that wasn't his style of guitar playing at all. And I think, like I said, I mean, he's playing on Crazy Nights. It's actually my favorite, you know, the albums that he was involved with. Crazy Nights, again, is my favorite guitar work from Bruce, although he did some great stuff on Asylum as well. I think Bruce was a massive, massive part of the Crazy Nights album. His stuff on Crazy Nights is just completely over the top, and I absolutely love it. I love the guitar sound on the album as well, and I think his solos are phenomenal throughout the whole album.
So I know we've both been reading Julian Gill's book, Danger Zone, An Exploration of Kiss's Crazy Nights, recently. And anyone who is interested kind of in what we're talking about on the podcast and wants to learn more about this album, I'd thoroughly recommend the book. It's absolutely fantastic. He talks a lot about kind of how vibrant Bruce's guitar is on certain tracks on the album. And he explains that by saying that Ron tried to bring out Bruce's guitar in a new way, presenting them more in the foreground, almost like a lead vocal, as a dynamic balance to the underlying keyboards and synths. So that explains to me why those solos in his guitar, and obviously as we go on, I'll point out particular moments on the album where I just absolutely love his guitar. And that, I guess that's why it's always stood out for me, because in the mix, it's not buried under, as you may assume it might be in an album with prominent keyboards. It's actually very much in the foreground, like a lead vocal.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the misconceptions about this album is that it's a real keyboard heavy album, and it's a very, very much a guitar based album. I think people were just kind of freaked out because Kiss were using keyboards and they'd never used keyboards. Crazy Nights is still very much a hard rock album with guitars still at the forefront. I think, like I said, I think it's a misconception. I think it's actually quite a tough album in places. Yes, you know, there's some softer songs, but there's some good hard rock songs on that album.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if I think about, I mean, I'm a huge Kiss fan, and I'm also a huge Queen fan, and Crazy Nights for me is almost, it's seen as like, I don't know how much Queen you listen to, but kind of their Hot Space. So obviously people talk a lot about Hot Space by Queen, how they kind of pulled back the guitars and then it was a lot more kind of synths, and it was Freddie Mercury and John Deacon kind of really pushing that forward. Crazy Nights really isn't their Hot Space because of, like I say, Bruce's involvement in it and how prominent the guitar is alongside the keyboards. It just creates this whole other sound.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. I also think, you know, another guy that obviously needs a mention is Eric Carr, who's drumming on this album is, you know, phenomenal. Again, it's, you know, I think Eric was my favourite drummer in Kiss as well. His playing on this album, you know, especially on, you know, songs like No, No, No and stuff like that. I mean, Eric's a, you know, absolute powerhouse on the drums.
Just before we go track by track, I've got one question, which is very much hypothetical, but it seems from the outside that Kiss have the right producer. They've got a stable lineup for the first time in years, and they've got this newfound enthusiasm to take over the charts. But because they take quite a while to produce the album, they waited for Ron Nevison. It's released in September. We've already seen albums like Hysteria and Appetite for Destruction released that summer, almost kind of beating Kiss to the punch. Do you think that if Kiss had been able to get their album out first, it might have achieved greater success?
It could have done. Up until that point, the 2 years in between Asylum and Crazy Nights was the longest period they'd actually had. Creatures of the Night was 82, Lick It Up 83, Animal Eyes 84, Asylum 85. And then suddenly there was this 2 year gap between those two albums. And like you say, I think in that gap, I think, you know, bands like Bon Jovi and Def Leppard and bands like that kind of got in there, like you said, you know, before Kiss really. And why the album wasn't a massive success, I don't know, because like you said, they had all the ingredients. They had a massive hit producer. They used, you know, Desmond Child co-wrote a couple of songs, who was obviously, you know, very important in the whole Bon Jovi thing. They had all the ingredients to have a massive, massive album. And I don't really know why. Sometimes I think maybe it was because maybe the record label were looking at the fact that Kiss were a lot older than, you know, a lot of those other bands. And maybe they were spending more money promoting and putting money into the kind of younger bands. And maybe, I don't know, maybe they saw Kiss as maybe at that time, maybe has-beens, you know, even though they definitely weren't. Why? I don't know.
Rob Wild there from Midnight City chatting with me about Kiss's Crazy Nights, and I hope you're starting to get a feel as to why this album's maybe been a little unappreciated and maybe worth revisiting with kind of a fresh pair of ears. But we're not done yet. We're about to go track by track and cover every song on the album. Coming up, which track on the album actually made its debut on a Wendy O. Williams solo album 2 years earlier? And what makes Reason to Live not only Rob's favourite song on the album, but his favourite song of all time? All that and more, right after this. Enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes, as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favourite band, or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blotter.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway, so yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash fight. I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird. I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. So now seems a great time to go track by track, and we'll start with our opening track, the big single, and the title track in some ways, Crazy Crazy Nights. So it was, as we said, the first single from the album and a major part of the album's success here in the UK. So for anyone who is listening from outside the UK, can you try and give us a flavour of just how big this song was and arguably still is over here?
Yeah, it's just, I absolutely love it. I think it's such a great song. I mean, it's probably the without a doubt, the most commercial song they've ever written. And just such a, you know, it's an anthem. It's an absolute anthem that just gets you as soon as the song kicks in. Like I said, you know, going back to being a 10-year-old kid and there's just no messing around. It's just banging straight into the song. And I just think the chorus is incredible. You know, it's such a hooky chorus. You know, like I say, a real anthem. And you know, why it wasn't, I mean, it obviously did well over here, but why it wasn't like a huge hit, you know, in the States is completely beyond me, because it's obviously very, you know, it's just made for that kind of market, you know, and especially what was happening at the time. I think Bruce is playing on it's incredible. I think the mix on that song is just fantastic. I've just been reading up a lot about the Kiss tour, the final Kiss tour and stuff, and been reading the set list and stuff, and it's pretty predictable, really. But, you know, the good thing is, with it being a massive hit in the UK, is whenever they come to the UK, Crazy Nights is always in the set list. So, you know, I'm happy about that. I read once that Paul Stanley always said that the first song on any album was really, really important because it kind of set the tone for what was to come on the rest of the album, you know, and I think that definitely kind of sets the stall out as to what kind of album you're going to get, you know what I mean? In a similar way to, you know, when Creatures of the Night came out, the title track, I mean, you just knew that this was going to be, you know, a heavy, you know, drum heavy album, guitar heavy album, you know, because they obviously they were coming off the back of The Elder after that. So they were really kind of wanting to make a, you know, a heavy metal album. And just in the same way that that kind of set up that album, you know, Crazy Nights definitely sets up what was to come on the rest of the album.
So, I mean, Crazy Nights is a great example of the debate from Kiss fans around the use of keyboards on this album. So Paul Stanley actually spoke to Classic Rock magazine in 2001 about the song. And he said, "It's a really good song, but I'm not terribly fond of its sound on the album. There are some songs that I think are absolute crap, but Crazy isn't one of them." Do you think that he's being a bit overly critical of the sound on this one? Do you think that possibly it because the album wasn't their biggest, it's almost cool to bash it a little bit?
I think so, yeah. I think if it had been a massive, massive album, I think he'd be saying something different. I do think, you know, I mean, with a different producer, I mean, this album probably would have, even with the all the same songs, say they used Michael Wagner or Bo Hill or, you know, any of those big producers from the 80s, it would have, definitely these songs could have sounded tougher. Maybe the keyboards wouldn't have been used, but they went to Ron Nevison for that exact reason, because he was, you know, he had a track record of producing massive, massive albums. And I think they probably put a lot of trust in him as well, because the two previous albums, Animal Eyes and Asylum, were both produced by Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons. So it was, you know, they basically done two albums that they produced themselves. So they obviously put a lot of faith into Ron Nevison and probably let him guide them in a lot of ways. You know, at the time, he was obviously producing an album that could compete against what was going on in 1987. And for that reason, I mean, he absolutely hit the nail on the head as far as I'm concerned.
And I think what's interesting, again, from reading Danger Zone, which we have been recently, that a lot of that dissatisfaction from Paul might come from the fact that the original demo had a crowd join in with the chorus, which has been somewhat toned down in the final song. But I still think, as you said, it is one of the kind of the great sing-along choruses, and it's possibly one of the strongest in Kiss's back catalogue, of which I think they're very good with the chorus. Crazy, Crazy Nights is one of the strongest ones.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think if you were to say, okay, you know, pick one song that sums up 80s Kiss, it's got to be Crazy Nights. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. So Crazy Crazy Nights was actually my first exposure to Kiss as well as a teenager. And as a result, I've always had a soft spot for it. And I feel like, as we've said, it's a really strong start for the album. And in fact, UltimateClassicRock.com readers voted it by a huge margin the best track on the album. Would you agree with that result? Or is there another track coming? And you don't have to say right now, but is there another track coming that you think's stronger?
Yeah, there's a couple. There's a couple, actually, yeah. I mean, I love that one, but there's probably another two or three that I think are equally as good, if not better, in my opinion. So we'll get to that.
Cool, definitely. So in spite of its popularity, Crazy Crazy Nights lay dormant in the band's set list for nearly 20 years, but made its triumphant return during the Sonic Boom Over Europe tour in 2010. Now, I was lucky enough to see them in Newcastle on that tour. Did you manage to get to any of those shows and see the reaction for that song when they kind of brought it back?
I wasn't, unfortunately. In that period, I was living in the States. But of course, with it not being a hit over there, they didn't play it. The first time I actually saw them, I was living back in the UK. I was actually at the Help for Heroes show that they did, which was like, oh, this is great. You know, so I was really happy to hear it, because like I said, when I go and see them in the States, it was never, ever in the set list, you know, but back in the set at the London show.
So we'll move on to I'll Fight Hell to Hold You, which is written by Paul Bruce and songwriter Adam Mitchell. So the song came from Paul's wish for a passionate song for the album. Do you think that passion comes across on a track like I'll Fight Hell to Hold You?
Oh, yeah. to me, this is Paul at his best. It doesn't get any more, there's no more like of a passionate delivery vocal-wise in this song. I mean, you really believe everything every single word he's singing in this song. And I think, again, you know, one thing I'd say about this album is Paul's vocals are just off the scale. This is really, for me, this is Paul at his absolute peak. He's just, you know, absolutely on fire on this album. And some of the notes he hits, that we're going to get onto the song My Way later on, but you know, on this song as well, some of the notes he hits are just ridiculous, and there's just so much passion and so much belief in what he's singing. Just really, really comes across in this song, and this is probably one of my favorite songs off the album. And I think it's just a really, really good, you know, it's a good hard rock song. You know, this is one of those songs that probably one of the songs that gets overlooked. You know, because this is a tough song. You know, there's nothing wimpy about this song at all. I just think it's a really cleverly written song. And like you said, Adam Mitchell was involved, who obviously wrote Cover Up Creatures of the Night. So I just think it's a really, really good hard rock song that's probably, you know, very much overlooked by a lot of people.
And I mean, it's interesting that when Adam Mitchell was interviewed for Danger Zone, Julian Gill revealed that he personally had a big problem with the song. I had a big problem with Paul going so high in his vocal range on the song that it becomes a little too high for my personal taste. Do you think, I mean, we've talked about how Paul's vocally is kind of at his peak. Do you think that he goes too high on this song, or do you think that it's what the song calls for?
That was a big thing about, you know, how high singers could sing in the stratosphere. You know, that was kind of what was being done at the time. So again, I think it was like I've said a few times now, I think it was them, you know, trying to compete with everybody else and what everybody else was doing. You know, that high register vocal, that was what was happening. You know, I mean, a lot of the bands, which a lot of people don't know, but back in the 80s, a lot of the singers would actually sing in a different key, and then they'd kind of basically transpose it up a couple of semitones so that even if they couldn't actually physically sing something, they wanted to compete against everybody else. I think it was very much a competition as to who could sing the highest, you know, who could play, you know, fastest on the guitar, you know, again, going on to the Bruce Kulick thing, you know, keeping up with Eddie Van Halen and all that kind of stuff. And I think it was everything about the 80s was OTT. And I think it was just everything. That was what was great about the 80s. It was just everything, you know, foot to the floor, everything 100%. So, yeah, I think it suits this song. It's probably one of the reasons this song was never, ever played live. There's a couple of songs on this album that were never played live, because I think it would pretty much be impossible to, even back then, you know, when Paul was in his heyday, I think it would have been impossible to recreate this song live and to sing in that pitch, you know, live in concert. For this album, absolutely. I think it shows, like I said, it just shows Paul at his absolute best, in my opinion.
So we'll move on to the extremely subtle title of Bang Bang You. Paul's been quoted as saying that this one is about the classic story of boys and their toys, and there's a nice nod to Kiss's classic single Love Gun in the chorus. What are your thoughts on Bang Bang You? And for a band that had songs like Love Gun and Let's Put the X in Sex, is this the most blatant song they ever came up with?
I think this is one of those songs when, you know, the kind of the diehard Kiss fans who really don't like Crazy Nights, I think this is one of the songs that they think of when, you know, if someone brings up the topic of Crazy Nights. I think they probably think of the song Crazy Nights, and they probably think of Bang Bang You as well. You know, and like I said, they often miss the deeper cuts like I'll Fight Hell to Hold You and stuff like that. I think Bang Bang You is very, very of its time. It's very dated. It's very hair metal. Like I said, obviously a reference to the Love Gun thing. I think maybe Paul was secretly trying to write a Love Gun for the 80s and obviously failed miserably, but I think, you know, it's a fun song. I mean, it's like I said, it's very of its day. I mean, the whole kind of double entendre lyrics, I mean, everybody was doing that in the 80s, you know, Warrant and, you know, Danger and all those bands. I mean, they were all writing really cheesy lyrics. That's what, you know, all those hair metal bands were about, really. And it's a fun song. I think the funny thing for me is when they went out on the Crazy Nights tour, the first kind of couple of shows on the tour, they played about five or six songs from Crazy Nights, and then night by night they just started dropping songs. But one of the songs that remained in the set for the entire Crazy Nights tour was this, which I'm really surprised about. It was dropped after the Crazy Nights tour. They never played this song live again. But this song was literally played every single night during the Crazy Nights tour. So they obviously must have liked it enough and thought that it was strong enough to be in the set, which is, you know, personally, I would have picked other songs, but like I said earlier, you know, I mean, songs like I'll Fight Hell to Hold You were probably really almost impossible to recreate live. So maybe this was just an easier song to play, an easier song to sing. Yeah, it's just a fun song. And, you know, it's definitely one of the filler songs on the album. But, you know, it's of its day. And I think it kind of served its purpose really at the time. So, yeah, you know, it's a fun, I mean, you can't kind of listen to it without like a smirk on your face. But, you know, but it's a fun song, you know, good tongue in cheek song.
So, I mean, Bang Bang You is one of many songs of Paul's from the 80s Kiss albums that was written with Desmond Child, who also wrote for Bon Jovi, Joan Jett and Alice Cooper. Other Desmond Child Kiss songs, for lack of a better term, include Heaven's on Fire, Reason to Live, which we'll get onto later, and perhaps most famously, I Was Made for Loving You. So you've got to believe, you know, the chorus to this song, this is a catchy song. There's just something about Paul Stanley and Desmond Child working together that they seem to create catchy, great songs that are just kind of ready for radio.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, Desmond Child is my favourite songwriter of all time. And I mean, I think the guy's almost incapable of writing a bad song. But I would say out of all everything he's written, I mean, I wouldn't say this was like a high point for him, really. I think I think he's done, you know, there's obviously a couple of songs we'll come on to later on this album. You know, which Desmond's up to his usual standard. I think this one was just, I think that the whole point of this song was just to, just let's write this fun kind of tongue-in-cheek song. Like, you know, let's pete against what Motley Crue are writing about and Poison are writing about.
So we'll move on to our first Gene track of sorts for the album, No, No, No. It starts with Bruce Kulick at his absolute finest. I end up thinking back to that quote about his guitar being presented almost like a lead vocal. And it really takes a guitarist with some serious chops to be able to live up to that kind of production. We talked a little bit earlier on. Am I right in you were saying that for you, Bruce would even trump Ace Frehley and Vinnie Vincent and all these guys? Bruce, for you, is the ultimate Kiss lead guitarist, yeah?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, I mean, obviously, I think everybody, all guitar players are different, all singers are different, and they all come from different backgrounds and different influences and stuff like that. I mean, Ace was brilliant for the 70s stuff, and, you know, he defined, you know, the Kiss guitar player in the 70s. But I think if, you know, he'd have, you know, stayed with a band in the 80s, I think he probably would have got a little bit lost because, you know, he wasn't, you know, he's not really capable of playing to, you know, especially not capable of being able to play that fast and play that kind of 80s rock style of guitar playing. So, absolutely. I mean, Vinnie Vincent was great as well. He was very flashy, very over the top. But I much prefer Bruce. I think the difference between it, Bruce and Vinnie, was I think Bruce, although he could play fast, he also had a really, really good sense of melody as well. Whereas I think kind of Vinnie was just really all about, you know, just look at how fast I can play, you know. There's some great melodies and, you know, some of Bruce's best stuff. I mean, like I said, the Tears Are Falling guitar solo, and then, you know, on the next album, Hot in the Shade, you know, his guitar solo on Forever, the ballad, just so melodic. So even though he can play fast and do all that stuff, he's also very mindful of writing really nice melodies and you know, some hooky guitar solos as well. I think this is the only song that I don't like on the album. And I remember hearing it as a kid and just thinking, I really don't like that song. And I've got to admit, you know, nothing's really changed. I don't think there's really a song here. It's just, to me, it just sounds like a jam. It just, I mean, the guitar intro with Bruce is fantastic. Eric's drumming is insane on this. There's no real hook. There's no real, it doesn't seem to have any structure, this song at all. It's just kind of, to me, it just sounds like it's just come out of a jam in a rehearsal room and it's kind of somehow found its way onto the album. I'm not really sure how or why, but there you go. I think this is sort of like a miss for me and the only miss for me on the Crazy Nights album.
And it's really interesting you should say that, because Bruce has called No, No, No his favourite Kiss song, on the album at least, because it's the fastest, ferocious thing, and it features me a lot.
Well, that's it. That song's really all about Bruce, really, and Eric as well, really, because I don't really think, like I said, I don't really think there's much of an actual song there behind it. I think it just seems, it almost starts like, you know, almost like, you know, it's just like a drum and guitar solo, you know, I mean, that's kind of, and then it's suddenly, okay, let's try and write a song out of that, and that just kind of seems how, to me, how the whole thing came together. But again, you know, what I was saying about No, 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 was, again, In the Kiss set, absolutely every night on the tour. So again, they must have liked it enough to keep it in the set, I guess, you know.
And I think there's something kind of, when I listen to this song, we've talked about Gene's lack of involvement during the sessions, but I feel like on this one, Gene, he at least sounds like he's enjoying himself on this one, which also bleeds over into our next track, which is Hell or High Water. Compared to the rest of the album, these two songs are kind of closer to that kind of hard rock sound on previous Kiss albums. Do you think that this was Gene's attempt to kind of counterbalance kind of the heavy keyboards on the rest of the album?
Absolutely, yeah. I think he probably saw what was going on, and he probably saw what, you know, the type of songs that Paul was writing, Paul was bringing into the, you know, to the album. And I think, you know, I think it was a good idea. I think he wanted to counterbalance that kind of pop with some more, you know, badass hard rock stuff, which is what Gene's always been about. You know, I mean, you couldn't imagine Gene, you know, writing a power ballad. You know, I mean, obviously he sang, he co-wrote that World Without Heroes and stuff like that, but I think for the 80s stuff, you know, I couldn't imagine, you know, Gene singing Reason to Live. You know, it's just not what he's about. And I think it was a very conscious decision to have some songs that were completely different to what Paul was writing. And there are a couple of songs on the album that don't have keyboards, you know, so it's not, you know, there isn't a keyboard on absolutely every single song. And I think this song's a really good song. I think it's got a really good feel to it. It's got a good swing to it, this one, and it's completely different to anything else on the album. And for Kiss in the 80s, you know, I think this is a really good song. You know, I think it's got a great chorus. Yeah, to me, this should have been in the live set rather than No, No, No. And, you know, I think it's a much, much better song than No, No, No. In 1987, I think this was a good effort from him.
So we'll move on to My Way, where the keyboards return in full force. And it also sees Paul Stanley back on lead vocals. So a demo of this one's actually floated around Kiss collectors over the years. Have you heard that demo at all? And does it differ much to what we hear on Crazy Nights?
There's actually a couple. In answer to your question, not really, no. But the actual song is, in terms of the structure and the actual, you know, the lyrics and the chorus and the melodies, it's pretty much exactly the same. You know, it's just obviously a demo version of it. But there is also on YouTube... and I don't know where this has come from, but there's an isolated Paul Stanley vocal take from this song. And it's basically just the entire song without any music, just Paul's vocals. And you can actually hear that the notes that he hits on this, that would have like dogs and cats, you know, barking. You know what I mean? Some of the notes he hits is just absolutely insane. And this is actually probably my favorite song on the album, which I know a lot of people, again, I have a lot of obviously friends who are Kiss fans, and nobody can believe, you know, everybody takes a piss at me because I absolutely love this song. And like you said, this is by far the big keyboard song, but you know, the biggest keyboard song on the album, because like we were saying earlier, I think even though keyboards were used on the album, to me, the guitars are still the forefront, you know, they're still ahead of the keyboards. But I think with this song, this is very much the keyboards are taking the front seat, and the guitars are kind of backing the keyboards up, really. But this song was also, I think one of the main reasons for that is Paul actually wrote this song on keyboards, which I don't think he'd actually done before. He's always obviously written on guitar, but he actually sat down and wrote this song on keyboards. And I just think it's such a great song. And, you know, the message is so good. And as a little kid, I remember this was... it meant a lot to me as a little kid because, you know, I was at school and I was this little rocker dude, and I used to get, you know, a lot of hassle from my friends at school who were, you know, because I was like the token rocker Kiss and Def Leppard and Bon Jovi, and I used to get picked on quite a lot at school. And I remember this song, it was like the first song that I really related to, you know, because when you're a kid, you just sort of, you listen to songs and you like songs because you like how they sound. You don't read the lyrics and kind of take all that in when you're a little kid. But I remember one day just coming home from school, and I had a lot of trouble with, you know, people name calling me and stuff like that. I remember putting this song on and actually reading the lyrics. And I just remember thinking it was the first time that I really connected and could relate to, you know, song lyrics. So I think that's also why I've got a real soft spot for this song, because it just kind of summed up where I was. And I just remember thinking, even as a little 10-year-old kid, that I really don't care what anybody thinks, because I love this band and I love this cassette, and I, you know, and I'm going to stick to what I like to listen to, you know, and I don't really care what anybody thinks of me. So that's probably why I have a soft spot for it. But I also think it's just a really, really great song. obviously a Desmond Child co-write. In the Danger Zone book that we've been talking about, this is also Ron Nevison's favourite song on the album. He thought this should have been a single. I think it should have been as well, really.
And I mean, on his official website, Bruce Kulick says of My Way, the keyboards are very much part of the production, but it somehow works on this track, maybe better than the others. Would you kind of agree with him? We've talked about kind of that this is the keyboard track. Is this the one where it, perhaps all the pieces come together the best to kind of make this sound that they were looking for?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is by far, I mean, I think this is the most AOR Kiss, the most AOR Kiss song, you know, ever recorded, really. You know, I mean, this could almost be, you know, it could almost be on the Van Animals Heart album or something. You know, it's got that kind of feel about it. You know, I could almost hear, you know, Ann Wilson singing this or something, you know. But there's a lot of people that have said that this song could have been, if it hadn't been so keyboard heavy, this could have actually been a really kind of tough song, you know. And it's kind of, again, like we were talking earlier about the passionate delivery and, you know, the passion behind, you know, I'll Fight Hell to Hold You. I think that's very apparent on this song as well, you know, just where you really believe when he's singing I'll Fight Hell to Hold You, you believe everything he's saying. And the same with My Way, he just sings it with such conviction, you know, and he just really, you know, he probably could have been, you know, like a much tougher song, but to me, it works perfectly. And yes, the keyboard players are, you know, really, really at the forefront and really in your face. But I think for this song, it just works very, very well, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, Bruce went on to say that there are elements of the song that remind him of their previous album, Asylum. And talking about Asylum and the tour that followed, When Your Walls Come Down, which is the next song, was one of the songs that was conceived during that tour. So the initial riff from Bruce was complemented by a chorus from Paul and some help from Adam Mitchell. Julian Gill says about this one, the song would get a rare live appearance on the Crazy Nights tour, but did not work out too well. Do you have any idea, kind of, with your experience as a musician, why this might be, why When Your Walls Come Down might have been a difficult song to translate to a live setting?
Yeah, I mean, a few reasons, really. I mean, sometimes when you go out and play songs, they just, number one, they might not go over that well, you know, so you might be playing, you know, for Kiss, maybe they'd be playing Love Gun or Cold Gin or Firehouse, and then suddenly they go into this song, and then, you know, the song finishes, and you can always tell if people have enjoyed a song or if, you know, a song isn't particularly going down that well with an audience. That's usually, you know, you might try it a couple more nights, and if every night that song doesn't particularly go down very well, then you think, okay, well, we'll maybe replace that song with something else. So that's one reason. And the second reason is, you know, sometimes songs are really hard to recreate live, especially when you're making albums like this, you know, and especially for Paul, you know, it's one thing singing those notes in a studio when you've got, you know, I mean, he probably spent, you know, 5 days singing one song, you know, but then you're put into a live situation. And some of these songs, like you keep mentioning, Fight Hell to Hold You, but I mean, that song would have been impossible pretty much to sing live. You know, I don't think that's probably the case with this one, but maybe it just didn't go down well with the audience. Why, I don't know, because I think this is a great song. This is probably the toughest Paul song on the album. Just a real kick-ass rock song. I think it's great. And the song was only in the set for about 3 nights or something like that. And then it was dropped and never to appear again. Why, I don't know, but I think this one's a really, really good song, and there's no keyboards on this song. You know, this again, kind of balances out the album, I think, you know, from the, you know, we've had the really kind of AOR melodic rock song on My Way and the end of Side 1. And then, of course, I'm still thinking in Side 1 and Side 2, because this would start out, you know, the second side of the album. And it's just, you know, I think it's just a really great song, great riff. You know, some really cheesy hair metal lyrics, but very much of the time. And I think it's just a really great track. I always love this one.
Yeah, so we'll move on to the big power ballad of the album, Reason to Live, the second single off Crazy Nights. I'm going to go on record and say this is actually one of my favourites on the album, and possibly one of my favourite Kiss songs, full stop. What are your thoughts on Reason to Live, and how does it fare as the big power ballad on the album?
Well, this song is not only my favourite Kiss song on Crazy Nights, it's actually my favourite song of all time, literally of all time. I think it's just and the most beautiful song I've ever heard in my life. I remember hearing it and just absolutely falling in love with this song. I mean, obviously, again, Desmond Child is involved. I think the production on this song is near to perfect. Just how everything sits, how the keyboards sit with the guitars, and just the whole sound of this song is just unreal. You know, it's such a great song. And you know, Ron Nevison saying that when Paul brought this demo in, he was convinced that they had a number one single. You know, he was absolutely convinced that this was going to be the song that would absolutely blow the album up. You know, in a similar way that Alone did for Heart, and you know, and like so many big, you know, at the time, of course, 87, you had Alone, Heart, you had Whitesnake, Is This Love, Love Bites, Def Leppard. You know, Ron Nevison was absolutely convinced this was going to be a hit. Why it wasn't, I will never know, because you know, a couple of years later, they had a big hit in the States with Forever off the Hot in the Shade album. And, you know, I think that's a great song, but I don't think it can even come close to Reason to Live for me. It's just, this song's in a whole other league, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, Paul recalls playing Gene the demo for Reason to Live. We've talked about kind of Ron's reaction to it. He played Gene the demo down the phone. He told Kerrang, I remember calling up Gene and playing it to him down the phone. I played the song to Gene, and obviously the bomb had gone off at the other end. He was speechless. And I'm very much of the same opinion as you, that had the album been a bigger success in the US, that Reason to Live would be up there with the likes of Forever, or perhaps even Beth, when we go back to the 70s, as one of the all-time great Kiss ballads. It certainly is for me and you, by the sounds of things.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I just think it's just absolutely, you know, an incredible song. You know, a lot of people, I never realised this, but there's a few people, I've read something not too long ago, and a few people were saying that it reminded them of Foreigner's I Want to Know What Love Is. And actually, when you listen to it, you know, until somebody points it out to you, which again was obviously a massive, massive hit for them. And when someone points it out to you and you listen to it and you actually think, oh yeah, it does. It's very similar. It's a very similar type of song. You know, the difference being one was an absolute, you know, gazillion selling single that, you know, still is played everywhere on every radio station to this day. And then the other one is, sadly for Kiss, a very kind of sort of almost criminally ignored song, really. And I'm pretty sure that when Paul wrote this song, when it was on the album, I think they've all been very disappointed that this. I think they probably realized after this was released, you know, the second single. I think it's one of those things, you know, if you can't get a hit single with that, then it's a shame, because, you know, like I said, I just think it's just the most perfectly written song of all time for me. Again, it was played on the Crazy Nights tour, but sadly, you know, it was I think Paul played it on his solo tour that he did in 89, but it never reappeared. So I think this one also this charted in the UK as well, if I remember rightly, but it was a really low chart. I think it was like 33 or something like that. I remember entering the charts and the next week it was gone. Yeah, it was to me, it was just, you know, it should have been a huge hit, simple as that.
And do you think, I know we talked about the album and timing, do you think that perhaps some of the issues of Reason to Live not being a bigger single, do you think that could have been to do with timing as well?
Yeah, it could have been. It could have been, you know, I mean, it could have been down to a lot of reasons, really. I mean, maybe it was released at the wrong time. I think timing is very important when with anything, really. We especially releasing singles, maybe it was just released at the wrong time when there was too many songs, you know, happening like that. You know, could have been something to do with that, you know. But, you know, there's also a lot to do with something I've kind of only recently started reading about the last few years, about this stuff that used to happen in the States with something called payola, which was basically record labels who would basically buy, almost kind of buy hit singles. You know, they would pick which bands on their label that they wanted to have the success, and there was almost kind of backhanded deals going on to kind of get songs in the charts and stuff. I knew nothing about this. If you Google it, it's fascinating when you read it. It could have simply been something to do with that, because, I mean, in the States at the time, I think Kiss were on, I think this album was on Mercury, which is, I think this, well, it was definitely Bon Jovi's label, and I think it might have been Def Leppard's label. So I guess, you know, if you're looking at those two bands, if you're, you know, at the record label, you're thinking, okay, which bands out of these are we going to really, really push? And probably, you know, unfortunately, Kiss probably got left behind in favor of, you know, the younger bands, I guess. You know, it could have been that. Or like I said, you know, just bad timing on their part, I guess.
And I know I keep going on about Bruce Kulick, but what sends this one over the top for me is his guitar performance, particularly later in the song. So I think the solo is perfect, and even kind of the little melodies that he puts towards the end, just complimenting Paul's vocal, it just really makes the song for me. I just think it's, I can't praise the song enough, personally. I think it's great.
Yeah, me too. I would love to, you know, I'd love to seeing this perform live. I don't think that's ever going to happen, you know, but yeah, I mean, it doesn't get any better than Reason to Live.
So we'll move on to Good Girl Gone Bad, another Gene song, as we head towards the back end of the album. Bruce says of this one, the groove is kind of Judas Priest-like, chugging along in a sexy manner. And the song features some of my favourite bass playing from Gene. Do you get that Judas Priest comparison? Do you kind of agree with that?
Yeah, I've read that, and I don't really see that at all. I mean, it's not something that springs to mind to me, but I think this is a really good Gene song. This is probably my favourite Gene song on the album. It's very, very Gene. You know, we've just had the massive keyboard power ballad, so we need to kind of get some toughness back in the band. And this is what Gene's all about. And I think, as I said earlier, I mean, he absolutely wrote some atrocious songs, especially in the mid-80s, you know, on Lick It Up and Animal Eyes. And even, you know, a lot of really dodgy songs on Asylum. But I really like this. I think this one, as far as Gene goes, very good. I mean, obviously, you know, none of these songs compete to anything that Paul's written, but I think it's a really decent song, you know, and I think it fits really well on the album. It's placed, you know, in the right place on the album. And yeah, I dig this one. I like the song a lot.
So to revisit that compliment about Gene's playing that Bruce gave him, I think people often forget Gene Simmons as a bass player because it's such a huge personality. You, especially kind of when the makeup's on, people just think of Gene Simmons, the demon. How do you rate Gene as a bass player on Crazy Nights and in general? And is Good Girl Gone Bad a good example of what you can do?
I think Gene's an absolutely awesome bass player, and he's so kind of overlooked and so kind of unappreciated, really. I mean, he's so, I think more so in the 70s, because I think he had a bit more room to play in the 70s. You know, a lot of his bass lines were just great. You know, the cool walking bass lines he would do, and you know, he would have a whole other melody going on in the song from the rest of the band, and he, you know, a really, almost like a really inventive bass player. His hero was Paul McCartney. So you can hear a lot of that kind of stuff in what he was doing, especially in the 70s. And then we got into the 80s, and especially on this album, with there being a massive, massive focus on Bruce, I think his bass playing sort of gets a little bit overlooked. I think his bass playing throughout this album is a little more simplistic than it would have been, you know, on the 70s stuff and the earlier, the heavier stuff. But I think that's, like I said, because there's not really all that much room, because sometimes when there's, you know, a lot going on, there's a lot of keyboards, there's the guitar stuff, there's sometimes you can't overcomplicate things, you know what I mean? So, but I think his groove on this is great. You know, I mean, this is one of those real kind of groove type songs, and he's always just really solid with Eric on drums. But as a bass player, just in general, he's phenomenal. He's really, really good. I mean, and when you compare him to, you know, the bass players of the 80s, you know, like people like Nikki Sixx and, you know, people like that who really weren't very good bass players, you know what I mean? They really weren't very good. Gene was and is very good. You know, he's a very inventive, very creative bass player. And like I say, I think just because of his persona and how he is, I think his playing really gets overlooked a lot. And it's a shame because he's a good player.
Absolutely. We'll move on to the final single for the album, which was Turn on the Night. We know it actually only charted here in the UK, where it reached number 41. But I feel like this one is almost kind of the secret weapon on Crazy Nights. It's, for me, it's a highlight of the album. How do you feel about Turn on the Night? And do you think it's one of the stronger tracks on the album?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the big songs for me on this album, Reason to Live, obviously, My Way, Turn on the Night, and Find Hell to Hold You, my kind of four favourites on it. Turn on the Night is such a great song. You know, it's Diane Warren, I think, co-wrote this one. And it's such a, again, this is a massive keyboard song in a similar way to, but it's got a very similar feel to My Way, really. Really upbeat, happy, major key song. And just such a great chorus. It's such a massive, massive chorus and such a sort of a radio-friendly song, I think, if you think about songs that, you know, should have been all over the radio and should have been, again, a massive, massive hit. This is one of those songs, and I'm clueless because it's such, has every single ingredient that you needed in 1987 to have a hit single. Again, what we were saying about Reason to Live being criminally ignored, I think this one, you know, as a kind of a happy, fun, almost like party rock song, this was the same thing. You know, I mean, it should have been absolutely massive. It's just such a feel-good song. I mean, Bruce is playing on it. He's off the scale. Classic, you know, 3.5-minute song. It's just, it's great, you know. The only thing I could say about the song, and I think a lot of people have said, I don't think this, but a lot of people who don't particularly like this album, a lot of the point over the years has been that a lot of these songs were kind of, they were good songs, but they were kind of generic songs and didn't necessarily say Kiss, if you know what I mean, where, you know, if you listen to, you know, your classic kind of, you know, Love Gone or Detroit Rock City, you instantly know it's Kiss. And I kind of get what people are saying, that I think this song could have been, you know, Heart could have recorded this song, or, you know, even, I don't know, you just think of the bands that were around at the time, a lot of these songs could have been their songs, if you get what I mean. It's kind of, it wasn't that original. I think that's what people had a problem with this album, was that it wasn't that sort of definite Kiss sound. It could have been any number of those type of bands. But, you know, back to what we're saying about the wanting a hit album, I mean, they delivered all the goods, you know. I mean, what more could you want? You know, you got the best power ballad of all time, in my opinion, and then you got a song like this. So, I mean, they had, surely when the album was finished, they must have sat down and all thought, we have absolutely got this one in the bag. And it's such a shame that it wasn't a massive hit, because I absolutely love this song. This one, again, was never played live on tour, which I always thought was a little bit strange. But yeah, great song, great song.
And it's interesting that we're talking about kind of, you know, how Reason to Live kind of gets forgotten criminally. Rock'n'RollGarage.com named Turn on the Night as one of its great forgotten songs in 2017. So again, it's another one that's just, it made a little bit of a splash over here, but, you know, it had all the ingredients, like you say, to be a big song in the late 80s. And for whatever reason, that just didn't happen.
Yeah. I think that Bruce plays it every now and then when he does. He goes out and does kind of like conventions and the odd solo gig here and there. This is always in his set. Bruce really liked the song. And I think they might have played it on the Kiss Cruise as well. I know he did a lot of these 80s songs that he was involved with. Yeah, again, this is just such a great song. And, you know, it's such a shame it wasn't a big hit, because it really should have been.
And we'll move on to our final track on the album, Thief in the Night. This one has quite an interesting history, in that it was originally recorded by Wendy O. Williams for her debut album, Wow. That's an album full of songs written by Kiss members. And I think I read somewhere that this song had been around as early as Creatures of the Night. And I can almost kind of hear that kind of Creatures vibe on this one. Do you get that kind of vibe from it? It's certainly very different from our previous track.
Definitely, yeah. I love this song. I think this is a really great Gene song. I think this is, again, you know, probably for me, this is kind of Gene at his best, really, in this sort of mid-80s period. It's a little bit creepy, a little bit sinister, very, very Gene. And what you were saying about the Wendy O. Williams thing is quite funny, because I read somewhere that I don't think Paul was aware of Gene had brought this song in that had already appeared on somebody else's album. I don't think Paul was actually aware of that. You know, I think this is just a great, great song. You know, it's quite a heavy song as well. And like I say, very, very in the vein of the Creatures. It could have easily sat on that album. And, you know, we've had the really happy AOR keyboard party rock song, and then we end the album with this really tough sort of almost nasty rocker, you know, that is just really, really, it's just got a great groove to it, and is absolutely, you know, the coolest thing really Gene did in the 80s, you know, by far, I think.
So it's an album that ultimately didn't achieve what Kiss wanted it to, but as we've said many times, it proved a big hit overseas, particularly here in the UK. And over 30 years on, I feel, as it sounds like you do too, there's some really cool stuff on this album, particularly that decision to place Bruce Kulick kind of front and centre along with the keyboards. In Kiss Behind the Mask, Paul said of the album, "I'd give it 3 stars. I think it's a better album than it wound up sounding. I think it's a bit plastic sounding. But I'd like to think that we've proven there's a lot more there than first appears." So with that in mind, how has Crazy Night stood the test of time for you?
Well, I still listen to it a lot. I get what he means about that it sounding a little bit plastic, and it does sound a little bit plastic, but it's very much of its day. A lot of those albums sound very plastic, you know. I was listening to Poison's Open Up and Say Ah the other day, another favorite band of mine, and that, you know, I love that album, but that again is very, very plastic sounding. You know, that one was produced by Tom Werman. You know, those albums did, you know, and I mean, obviously there's albums like Hysteria, but, you know, obviously, Crazy Nights didn't cost, you know, a gazillion dollars to make. I mean, obviously they'd spent a lot of money on it, but it wouldn't have been that to that degree. But it's very much of its time. The production is very much of its time. But I think the songs still really, really stand up. You know, I think they're great songs. I mean, there's a couple of, you know, I think No, No, No for me is a pretty poor song. And but apart from that, you know, I even think that, you know, most of the Gene songs on the album are actually really good. You know, for me, they're the best songs that Gene wrote after Creatures of the Night until Revenge in those kind of three or four albums. His best songs are on Crazy Nights. And I think Paul, you know, Paul, arguably some of the best Paul Stanley songs, period, for me.
And finally, why is Crazy Nights your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
I think it's just number one because it's just so overlooked. I had a good friend of mine, actually, who lives in the States, and I can't remember how I got talking to him. I was talking to something about the Final Kiss tour, and we just got chatting online. And he'd actually recently revisited it, and he actually said, you know, at the time I absolutely hated it and kind of stuck it in, you know, the CD shelf with all the rest of the CDs and never really listened to it again. And he's actually gone back to it recently, and he actually realized that it's actually a really good album. So I think for that reason, I think I would get people to check it out because it's just a really, really overlooked album, you know, to the Kiss fans out there and to people who aren't into Kiss, you know, even, you know, the guys, you know, Miles, our guitar player from Midnight City, was never really a big Kiss fan, but, you know, he didn't know about how, you know, melodic this album is and how kind of AOR of this album can be at times as well. So it's just, you know, if you like melodic rock and that kind of stuff, this is, you know, as kind of melodic rock as Kiss got. And, yeah, it's just you just got to check it out. It's just a classic, and if you don't like it, then you can, you know, answer to me. I'll convince you why you should like it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, well, thank you very much for joining us once again. It's been great to talk Kiss. I'm always happy to talk about Kiss and other bands like that on the podcast. I know that Midnight City have been doing really well. What are you guys up to this year and kind of through the summer?
Yeah, it's been great. Well, our second album, There Goes the Neighborhood, came out in October, and it's been selling great. You know, it's been going really, really well. And we just got back from playing the Rockmantic Festival up in Carlisle. The next thing for us is we're actually playing the Hard Rock LAOR Festival in Wales on March 16th, and the Dementia Aware Fest in Maine in Wolverhampton. And then in June, we're actually going out on a 6-date UK tour, which is going to be announced hopefully this week, actually, either this week or next week. So, yeah, we're going to be playing all over the UK in June. So, yeah, just keeping busy. And, you know, there's going to be a couple more singles from the album as well. So, yeah, it's going to be really busy. We're going to spend the rest of the year kind of promoting this album and then hopefully looking to do an album 3 early next year.
Awesome. Well, Rob, thanks again.
You're welcome, man.
For joining us.
You're welcome. Cool. I've enjoyed it. Cheers, mate.
A big thanks to Rob Wild for rejoining My Classic Album, for coming back and bringing with him an album that we could really get our teeth into. And I hope that Kiss fans maybe might go back and revisit Crazy Nights and have another listen to it. I'd love to know what you think, Kiss fans or non-Kiss fans, listening to the album, be it your first time in 30 years, be it your first time ever. Is it an album that you still go back to from time to time? Let us know on the My Classic Album social media pages. Just search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook and like the page. You can follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast and indeed on Twitter at MCA_podcast. Midnight City's latest album, There Goes the Neighbourhood, is out now. It's been out for a few months. And if you're into that kind of 80s glam metal, if you're into these bands that we've been talking about with Rob, you're absolutely going to be into Midnight City. They've just announced a UK tour, which he was just talking about there. At the end, they're going to be playing Bradford, Stoke, Nottingham, Cannock, Crumlin and Grimsby throughout June. And I've got a feeling they're going to be doing more dates at the back end of the year as well. And if you can't wait that long, if you go into Hard Rock Hell's AOR Festival, they're going to be there on the Saturday on March the 16th. All the details for all their dates and the album and everything about Midnight City, get to their Facebook page at Midnight City. And that's it for another edition of My Classic Album. But as I said, we're going to be staying in 1987 for our next episode of the podcast. So very, very excited. We're going to be doing Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses. Our special guest will be Skunk Manhattan from the band A Good Rogering. And if you're a Guns N' Roses fan, this is one not to miss. Thoroughly enjoyed chatting to Skunk. Thoroughly enjoyed chatting about the album. It's about time Appetite for Destruction joined all the classic albums that we've discussed so far. So until then, I've been Mike Norris. and I will see you in a couple of weeks. Cheers.